Are there seats in here? If people want to sit in here, there's plenty of room. Cushions and chairs. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this morning I'm going to talk about... I'm going to actually let these guys come in, and you guys don't have to go back in the corner there. Why don't you just come in this room? We're all friendly. We like each other. We have chairs. We have cushions. Pretty soon we'll be having chaise lounges as we get older. So this morning I'm going to talk about yoga and Zen. But I'm not going to talk about Hatha yoga. I'm going to talk about the four traditional paths of yoga and how they really are integrated into Zen practice, whether you know it or not. yoga really predates Buddhism. The Vedas and the Upanishads, which are like 600, 800 before the contemporary era. But they were specifically the four classical paths to awakening in yoga come from this articulation in the second century before Christ, the same time as the Pali Canons, which is quite interesting. Quite interesting. And, of course, India, the same place, India. So yoga. Yoga is the root word in Sanskrit is to yoke. To yoke. To unify. To unify with your true nature, which is in Hinduism your Atman. In Buddhism it's your Buddha nature. And of course Buddhists are very adamant to talk about how the Buddha nature is different from the Atman. But forget that. It's just sectarianism from my point of view. It's just sectarianism. But, you know, they go on and on about anatman. Anyway, I'm not getting into that today unless that comes up in the questions. I can do a whole series of lectures on that one. So we're dominated, according to the yogas, by jiva, by little needy ego. Little knee ego up here, always worrying, always complaining, always upset, always trying to figure things out, find a way for himself, herself in this difficult world. But this jiva is only this, and our real nature is Atman. Our real nature is Atman, and Atman is great quietness at the center of our being, great stillness, great openness, and it's one with what? Brahman. Atman and Brahman are one. Brahman is the formless God who is no God and yet is completely God. Atman and Brahman are one, right? Classical Hindu teaching, which, of course, well, I'm not going to get into the Buddhist part, although it's all in Buddhism. That's what my point today is. It's all in Buddhism. So as practices, we're yoking ourselves. We're joining ourselves to our true nature, our still and luminous nature, which is joined to all life. And we do it by practicing one of the four classic yogas. The first classic yoga comes from Patanjali Sutra in the second century before the contemporary era. And the preliminary is Hatha Yoga. Everybody in the United States thinks Hatha Yoga is yoga. It's only, if you read Patanjali, it's just how you start. Just how you start. You get ready for Raja Yoga by doing Hatha Yoga. And of course, we do Hatha Yoga here in our retreats. We do some stretching. It's good. It's healthy. But Raja Yoga is so I'm going to talk about four yogas today. I'm going to talk about Raja Yoga. I'm going to talk about Bhakti Yoga. I'm going to talk about Jnana Yoga. And I'm going to talk about Karma Yoga. And I've talked about these before, but it's probably been 5 or 6 years. I know them very well. in terms of my own practice in my own life. I just don't talk about them too much because I don't like to confuse you Buddhists. that's kind of a joke, you know. But my point today is that they're part and parcel, all of them, of Zen Buddhist practice, whether we know it or not. So Raja Yoga is simply Zazen. Zazen. Here's what they say, and Patanjali says, when the mind has been trained to remain fixed on a certain internal or external location, there comes to it the power of flowing in an unbroken current towards that point, which he refers to as jhana, D-H-Y-A-N-A. Jhana, translated into Chinese, is chan, translated into Japanese is zen. Zazen. Zazen. What you guys were doing who were just before this started, those of you who are sitting here, zazen, what we do every day here, Raja Yoga. Raja Yoga. Bringing our mind back, sitting quietly, bringing our mind back, bringing our mind back, bringing our mind back, bringing our mind back, until the jiva just settles down, and we realize this great, wonderful spaciousness that's available continually, but that we overlook. Okay, so that's Raja Yoga, the kingly yoga, the Rajas, right? And Buddha's statement, when he decided he was going to die, now, you know, there's controversy about whether he decided he was going to die or whether he didn't decide, you know, or whether he just got food poisoning and died. But one of the myths is that he decided he was going to die. And he decided he was going to die because everybody was getting too dependent on him. They weren't doing their Raja Yoga. They were looking to him. So he said, do not look to me. Look to the Dharma. Become a light unto yourself. That's Raja Yoga. Become a light unto yourself. The light's here. It's always here. It's always emanating. But because of the jiva, the monkey mind, the poor little monkey mind, we overlook it. We miss it time after time after time. And it's here. It's always available. It's always joyful. Joyful. So we are the Zen school. We are the Zazen school. We are the Raja Yoga school. Bodhidharma is our mythological hero, or maybe real hero. Because he did what? Because he sat in meditation in Zazen for 9 years. Steady for 9 years. He's our hero. He's our Raja Yoga hero. He depended on himself. He kept his body erect. He let all that stuff churn through him. And he gradually began to disidentify with it. And as he disidentified with it, he opened up. He opened up to something very, very pristine, very still, and very joined to everything. In our contemporary retreats, we do in a Raja Yoga way. That is, we don't do much except sit. Although I noticed the last contemporary retreat, they did a lot of other yogas too. But in a real, if we did it the Bodhidharma way, we'd just be sitting and walking. That's all we'd be doing, sitting and walking and sitting and walking. Sitting and walking and sitting and walking. And our Raja Yoga practice here, our Zazen practice here, like Patanjali says, we emphasize daily meditation and then immersion retreats. Daily meditation and immersion retreats. So I studied Spanish. Started studying Spanish when I was in the 8th grade, 7th grade. Daily. Practice daily. My teacher said, you have to practice daily if you're going to learn Spanish. We did. I was good then. I practiced. There was a period in my life I was a good boy. I practiced daily. And she said, and then you have to immerse yourself, too. You have to immerse yourself. So I went to Mexico once, twice, three, four times. I immersed myself, but I was with my family, I was with my friends. I only partly immersed myself. Then I went to Guatemala with my wife for a week, part of Guatemala where nobody spoke any English. And the whole thing was total immersion. I guess it was 10 days, like a 10-day Rohatsu Sesshin. Total immersion, nobody speaks any English. You have to speak Spanish all day. You have to listen Spanish, hear Spanish. That's all you know is Spanish. although you don't know it, you don't feel like it's getting in. Just like when you're doing your meditation, you don't feel like anything's happening lots of times. You just keep coming back, coming back. And one day, about the ninth day, I had a dream, and I dreamed it was all in Spanish. I knew that finally Spanish was getting in me. I knew it was finally getting in me. Finally, this meditation will get in you. If you persevere, it will get in you. It will affect your dream life. If it affects your dream life, your whole life is going to be affected, you know. Because that translucence, that transparency, that openness, if you experience it in your dreams, you will experience it in your waking life too. No doubt about it. No doubt about it. So that's Raja Yoga, the kingly yoga. Second classical yoga path is bhakti. Bhakti yoga. How many of you know the word bhakti? Raise your hand if you know the word bhakti. A few. Devotional yoga. Devotion to the chosen deity. The chosen deity. And of course, in the Indian pantheon and the Hindu pantheon, lots of deities to choose from. Of course, we don't have deities in Buddhism. Oh, yeah, right. Right. We have bodhisattvas and Buddhas. Lots of them. And we don't even get to choose our deity necessarily. Every morning here for years and years and years, and before that in San Francisco for years and years and years, I've chanted the Heart Sutra. Every morning, I chanted the Heart Sutra. And the last part of this Heart Sutra, since I'm the head priest, the last part of the head sutra, we say, a bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita. And then I bow to prajnaparamita. And the mind is no hindrance. Bhakti is a heart practice. The mind is no hindrance when we open up our hearts. Monkey mind can go all at once when we open up our hearts. When we give ourselves away, the mind isn't a hindrance anymore. You know that when you really give yourself away to someone you love. You know that. Your child, your friend, you know that. It's a heart practice. Bhakti. Of course, Buddhism is non-theistic, right? It is non-theistic, but it's also very theistic. Because there are all these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas all around. One of them is Prajnaparamita. So I start out in this Heart Sutra, two-thirds of the way through it, I'm bowing to Prajnaparamita. Who am I bowing to? Who is Prajnaparamita? Who is Prajnaparamita? Anybody? You don't get this talk, Ben. You or Ted. Who is Prajnaparamita? Anybody know who Prajnaparamita is? Anybody? Prajnaparamita is the mother of all the Buddhas. She's the mama of all the Buddhas. So I bow to mama of all the Buddhas. Mama. A bodhisattva depends on Prajnaparamita, and the mind is no hindrance. When I give myself to mama, the mind's no hindrance. And then later in the sutra it says, all Buddhas depend on Prajnaparamita, and I walk around the altar and I bow to mama again. Mama. And then it ends. Maha Prajnaparamita. That's how the whole sutra ends. Great Prajnaparamita. Great mother of all Buddhas. So this is our bhakti practice. And you know, if I had known that Zen had any bhakti practice when I started, I never would have done it. Because I was a be a light unto yourself guy. I was none of this devotional stuff that yucca we had in our Catholic church and half of my family. Yucca. Right? But it's cool. It's cool. And it's a healthful heart practice. It's a healthful heart practice. My root teacher said, his teacher had a huge callus on his forehead from bowing all the time, from bowing to the floor all the time. Now, I wondered about that. He had his bowing cloth. It must have been a very rough floor underneath. A huge callus. We had a Zen teacher here once about 9 or 10 years ago named Diane something or other. Maybe you guys remember her. She spent a year at a monastery in Japan. And it was a Zen monastery, and I asked her about the practice, and she said, well, I said, how much zazen did you do? She said, zero. I said, what did you do all day? She said, we chanted and bowed, and we did orioki, and we chanted, and we did manual labor, and we chanted and bowed. And I said, that's not Zen. She said, oh, it's not, huh? Well, what do you think this was? It was a Zen temple. So we have the bhakti tradition in Zen. And, of course, you can be more a Raja Yoga person. You don't have to do this bhakti stuff. You can just come to our contemporary retreats. We do no bhakti. On Sunday, we do not no bhakti. Sometimes I just can't help but do a little gassho to you, like this morning. I just so in me, I did it. Or you can do a bhakti practice. Or you can do both. This is Zen offers. Zen actually integrates all four of these. Integrates all four of these. I actually think they're all important. They're all important. So giving yourself away to the chosen deity. It's the chosen deity. Any deity. Any deity. Surrendering. Opening your heart. I've talked before about my shamanic work. I've talked before about my teacher Elmer. So when you do a homblecha, raise your hand if you know the term homblecha. Do you know it from me or do you know it, Ben? He knows a lot. When you, a homblecha is a vision cry. It's a hard practice. It's a division cry. You cry to the big Great Spirit. You cry to the Great Spirit for support, for help. You're only a two-legged. Two-leggeds need a lot of help, not a sport. They get caught by their jivas. They get caught by their monkey minds. They cry for support. So when we do a homblecha called a vision cry, and I haven't done one in years, and I will probably never do one again because I'm too old and decrepit. Well, that's okay. No big deal. Everybody gets old and decrepit. Yeah, it'll come to you too. So, homblecha, I go up to the top of the hill with my pipe, and in my pipe that my teacher's given me, it's full of tobacco, and each piece of tobacco is a species. So all the species of the world are there in the bowl of my pipe, all the species of the world. And then I'm up there for 4 days and four nights. I don't eat. I don't drink water. I have a blanket and my pipe. It's summer, so don't worry. It's summer. And it's shady. It's shady. It sounds very deprivatory. Yeah, it is pretty deprivatory. Yeah, I guess it is. But it elicits crying for help. You want to cry for help. You want to cry for support, even if you don't believe in the Great Spirit. You'll cry for the Great Spirit. Even if you're atheist, you're going to cry for the Great Spirit when you do a homblecha. It's wonderful practice. Wonderful practice. Wonderful. And you do cry. You do cry because you're just a two-legged. You can't do this. You can't do this. This is just your jiva that thinks he or she can control stuff. You can't. When your true nature knows that you can and just accepts you and loves you. As you are. You're Atman, which is Brahman. Right? Right? So, on my altar up on the on the second floor, where, and I've been, had that altar now for, I don't know, 10 or 11 years, however long I've been guiding teacher here. Before I had it at home, but then I moved it here when I became guiding teacher. Well, the usual Buddhist guys, and then there's this strange woman in white robes. Anybody notice this strange woman in white robes on my altar? Where does she come from? Is she not Buddhist? Hard practice. Devotion. Devotion. The time in my life, after I left Zen Center for a while, I did shamanic work, and I also did devotional, bhakti work. But I didn't have to go somewhere to do it. It's right here. Devotion. Amachi. Amachi. How many of you know Amachi? Raise your hands. One. Two. Okay. So, within the bhakti tradition, Amachi, Indian woman who at about 16, 17 years old, was having lots of problems in her life and decided that she would do a devotional practice. She would devote herself to chanting and praying and asking for help and all her suffering, all the suffering she found around her. And she had a great transformation. And now she's the hugging guru. You may have heard of the hugging guru. She goes around all the world hugging people. You chant and pray all day. Everybody does it in a singing way, and then you go hug her, and then you chant and pray more, and then you go hug her more. But there'll be 1,000 people waiting to hug her. It's transformational for me to do that. I did that after I left Zen Center, after I did shamanism, and I was so sensitive and so emptied out by doing that, that when I went back to my little hotel room one night toward the end, I sat up in Zazen in bed. I woke up at like 2 a.m. and sat up in my Zazen in my Raja Yoga posture. And everything was totally still and spacious. And I saw this little building here, this little Zen Center, which had been part of my life for most of my life. And I saw myself coming back to it. I said, oh, this is... And so I came back. So she's up there on my altar. She's up there on my altar. So, Raja Yoga is Jiriki, self-power. In Japanese, get this, self-power. And lots of Japanese Buddhism is only Zen is self-power in Japanese Buddhism, because that's where we emphasize sitting. Sitting, meditation, become enlightened yourself. Most of Japanese Buddhism is devotional. It's Tariki, it's other power. You give yourself away to the other. But of course, these are not two. We're just, by giving ourselves away, we're letting go of all the ideas and thoughts about ourselves that prevent our sense of separation. We're giving that away. We're humbling ourselves. We're becoming humus. And by sitting quietly, we're letting go of all these thinkings, all these constructs, all these worries and all these fears, and we're also have the same realization, the same awakening to our lack of separation, to our intimacy with all life. So they're the same. They're just different ways, and it depends on kind of what type of a person you are, what your orientation is, and do both. Try both. Why not? And the third one, which is less known, is jnana yoga. Jnana. J-N-A-N-A. Prajna. J-N-A. Jnana. J-N-A-N-A. Jnana means to know in Sanskrit. It's about knowing. It's about knowing the still spaciousness that's the center of your being and all being. It's about knowing that. It's not about knowing things, ideas, Atman, Zen. That's not what it's about. It's about knowing. And a jnana yogi would like the first part of the Heart Sutra a lot. Because what a jnana yogi does is the practice of neti-neti. N-T-I-N-T-I. Not this. So whatever thought comes into your head, not this. Whatever emotion comes to your head, not this. Whatever planning you're doing, not this. Whatever desire you have, not this. Because that's just all your monkey mind stuff. Not this. Neti. Ramana Maharshi. Raise your hand if you know Ramana Maharshi. A few of you do. Ramana Maharshi, the great jnana yogi. When he was in his 20s, he decided he had a great urge to kind of peel away all of the thoughts and concerns and discover himself, Brahman, Atman. So he for 24 hours... Only for 24 hours, he did a neti-neti practice. Not this. Anytime he had a desire, anytime he had a thought, and not this, not this. And then when it came up, well, if not this, who am I? Then he did who. Am. I. Not this, not who, not I, not am. Who. Great practice. really. With your being. So the first part of the heart sutras is what we do. We say, not this, not that, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no path, no attainment, no lack of attainment, no da-da, no. So it's a jnana practice. We're becoming jnana yogis. But then, of course, we switch to becoming bhakti. But bhakti, that's all I say. So, and then we have koans in Zen. Well, koans are all jnana yoga practices. That is, a koan, we're asking ourselves a question, a deep question about some paradox, some contradiction, something that we don't get, something that splits us off. We're asking a question. And the original koan really is, who am I? If I'm not all these thoughts, if I'm not all these worries, if I'm not all this Tim stuff my mom told me, my dad told me, who am I? That's the koan. That's all the koans are based on that. 342 koans are that. Who are you? Who are you really? Really? So that's jnana practice. Jnana practice. Although jnana practice is not practice. When you say to Ramana Maharshi, I'm doing jnana practice, he says, what's practice? Who's practicing? What are you trying to get to? Oh, I'm not trying to get to anything. I'm just doing practice. He said, look into that, this practice that you're doing. I don't see it. Show it to me. Where is it? This is the great Ramana Maharshi, who is the father of the koan system, doesn't even know what koans were and came much after. All the koans were invented. He didn't know. So in a way, of the three I've talked about and the fourth one I talked about, jnana is the hardest. Jnana is the hardest because there's no practice. You can't say, oh, I can do my zazen now. Oh, you know, we need our zazen. I have my practice. I do it at 7 a.m. and then 6 p.m. and it helps me. Who's doing practice? What practice? What zazen? Who? So it's, in a way, the hardest. I do my chanting now. What are you chanting about? Who's this chanting? What is this chanting? Ooh. But it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Jnana yogis, if you're a Myers, if you're a high-thinking person on the Myers-Briggs, then jnana yogi, you can be a jnana yogi. If you're a high-feeling person in the Myers-Briggs, you can be a bhakti yogi. Pretty easily. Are you following me, you guys? How many of you know the Myers-Briggs? Raise your hand. Oh, I finally hit on something. Yeah.
You know what? Here's my question. How's the jnana yoga really different from a monkey mind?
From what? From a what?
From the monkey mind.
Oh, because you are asking. You are asking. You are saying not this thought. Not this desire, and then you are asking what, who. So you actually slow your mind way. Your mind slows way down when you go into deep asking. Way down when you reject every thought. Huh? You don't think so?
No, I just said, are you interviewing your monkey mind?
What?
Are you interviewing your monkey mind? Is that what you mean?
Yes, but you don't give your monkey mind any space. And anyway. Yeah, interviewing. She says, "Are you interviewing your monkey mind?" I would say there's challenging your monkey mind, challenging it moment after moment. But who is challenging it? Who? Great Zen masters in your hara. Who? In the Zen Rinzai temple. You do a Rinzai then. I don't know if you do it. I don't think many people do it anymore. Anyway, these Rinzai teachers abuse all their students, so who want to go near them? God, I wouldn't. And I'm almost 70 years old and a guy. If I were a young woman, I'd stay away from them. Sorry, but look at all the stuff that's been happening. And the fourth yoga is karma yoga, right? Karma yoga. Karma yoga. Wholehearted activity in the world. In the world. Results are unimportant in karma yoga. Expectation is totally unimportant. That doesn't mean we don't aim for something. We're aiming for something. When we do those dishes, we're aiming to get them clean. But if we have to do them a second time, a third time, a fourth time, no big deal. It doesn't matter. We're yoking ourselves to our activity. We're yoking ourselves. And the mind calms down when you yoke yourself to your physical activity. It's just a natural, doesn't it? If you're thinking about 30 things, you're not really washing the dishes wholeheartedly. You probably will have to wash them again. Right? Karma yoga. Wholehearted activity in the world. Zen is so much about this. So much about this. Buddhism before Zen had no manual labor. Before 7th, 8th century, we have Buddhism for 900 years. No monks, nuns didn't do any manual labor. Maybe nuns did, but monks didn't do any manual labor. Poor nuns probably did. That's another... You know, monks just begged, and they didn't do manual labor. But Zen, as soon as Buddhism came into China, Zen developed manual labor as a meditative, as a karma yoga, joining to all life, contributing, sharing your rice with others, cultivating your rice with others. Then it became integral to Zen practice, manual labor, physical activity, integral to Zen practice. When I started Baijiang in China, a day without working is a day without eating. But this is not some Calvinistic thing. This is a practice. This isn't to be good, or this is a practice of yoking yourself. And you know they took the story. They took Baijiang's tools away from him. They took his shovel and his hoe and his broom away from him when he was 83 years old, and he didn't come to the food hall. He'd come to the food hall. Well, because, and they said, why aren't you coming? And he said, a day without working is a day without eating. So they gave him all his tools back, and he was happy. He was happy. In the world, we're in the world. Each activity is a manifestation of our still nature if we give ourselves to it. And jiva just gets out of the way if you give yourself to the activity, doesn't it? Monkey mind just gets out of its way. It may only get out of the way for this long, but that's okay. Don't worry about it. This long is all. It's huge, this long. Really? Don't worry about it. So, my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, he emphasized no gap between sitting meditation and work in the Zendo. No gap. So on Saturdays, every morning in San Francisco, we did zazen, and then we did manual labor. We did zazen, and we had breakfast sometime there, too. I can't remember when it was. I said, well, I'd like to be a priest sometime. And he said, okay, but he said, you seem to favor zazen over cleaning the floor. He said, you'll never be a priest if you favor zazen over cleaning the floor. That's the true cleaning the floor is zazen. Right? That's what my teacher said. Although he was very gentle. He wasn't Rinzai. But he said, he probably just winked at me when he said that or something. Or gave me a little poke. But just a gentle, loving poke. So I started a Zen group many, many years ago in my hometown of Palo Alto with Stanford students. And Suzuki would come down every week. And he asked me to start it. So he came. It was his thing, but he asked me to start it. And it was on a weekday morning. and we would do zazen, and then we cleaned the whole house. And I said to him, well, I have a class. We have classes. We're students. We can't clean the whole house. We came for zazen. He said, oh, then we'll have to start earlier. So we started earlier, because he said, cleaning is part of it. Cleaning is part of it. Everyday life. Everyday life. Giving yourself to something, concrete physical labor. Concrete physical labor. And joining to the world. And then the house looked beautiful. And these guys, this was a graduate student's house. They'd get up in the morning, and, you know, about 9 or 10, they'd miss their first couple classes, and they'd look in the house and they go, wow, it's so beautiful. Now, was he doing that as some moralistic thing? No. Was he doing that as a punitive thing? No. That's not what this is about. Our work is play, because we're not about expectation or result. What's the difference between work and play? What's the difference? You completely give yourself to it. Do you know the difference? Tell me the difference. Tell it to me. This is Zen, you guys. This is karma yoga. So, when I was practicing in the 60s and the 70s, Morita therapy was big in Japan. And I don't know if it still is. I mean, I haven't gone online ever to look it up and see if it's still there. Morita therapy was big in Japan. Morita therapy was based on Zen, and it was developed for people with bipolar disorders, people with schizophrenia, people with anxiety disorders, people with depression. And, of course, there weren't meds in those days. Well, there were, but they were really bad. If you think the meds are bad now, you should have seen what they were like then. It was mostly physical labor all day, physical activities all day. A little bit of sitting, short periods of sitting, but not too much sitting. Not too much sitting, because if you're in a lot of distress, sometimes sitting actually magnifies your distress. It magnifies your distress. So karma yoga sometimes is needed more than Raja yoga in certain situations, certain times. We're going to be doing initiation here this year, which I do every 2 years, and some people are going to do it with me. We're going to initiate people who haven't been initiated, who are interested in the Zen Buddhist tradition. And what are they going to spend most of their time doing? Sewing strips of cloth together. The amount of time spent sewing is like 95% of the time. The amount of time spent doing devotional stuff is like 1%. The amount of time sitting is spent 1%. It's sewing. This is a karma yoga practice that is so part and parcel of Zen, since its very beginnings. And then we have someone like Ryokan. I'm not going to talk much about Ryokan. Ryokan was a great karma yogi. He did a lot of calligraphy. He did a lot of walking around, and he did a lot of playing with kids. Playing with kids was one of his main karma yogi activities. One of his main karma yoga activities. And he didn't do it to get anywhere. He did it to manifest the Atman, which is joined to all life. But he didn't have that idea in his head. If you practice, you just do it. The kids are there and you have fun. And then your mind is not in its worry mode anymore. All of a sudden it's gone. This is gone. Gyate. Anytime you give yourself to something, anytime you do karma yoga. And then, of course, karma yoga is physical activity, and then it is also service beyond self. In other words, bodhisattva activity, big bodhisattva activity. Ram Dass, I haven't heard about Ram Dass for 10 years. Is he still alive? Does anybody know if he's still alive? Oh, Do you know anything about him?
He had a stroke about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, I know that.
He's got a some sort of a compound in Hawaii.
Oh, cool. I'm glad he's still around. So, great karma yogi, Ram Dass. Great karma yogi. Yeah. And he spent time in India. He really liked Gandhi's statement, my life is my message. My life is my message. And he said to himself, if I can be like Gandhi with that message, that makes my whole incarnation a service. My whole incarnation, my whole life a service. So he started, I saw him at Stanford in 1966 or something when he was still doing acid. But he left that phase. He left that phase in about 68 or 69 and went to India and immersed himself in karma yoga practice. Karma yoga practice. And so then he came back, and in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s he started the prison ashram project, which is still flourishing. He did the Dying Project, which is still flourishing. He started something called the Seva Foundation. I don't know what they do. Does anybody know what they do? SEVA. His own work on conscious aging, then when he had a stroke, that became his work. That became his karma yogi work, yoga work, to work with his trying to learn how to use utensils again, how to speak again. And then help other people do that. So, see, I haven't heard about him in several years, so I'm glad he's still alive. But he'll be gone too. We'll all be gone. But he's not gone. When he goes, he doesn't go, because look at his legacy. Look at his legacy. Wow. Wow. So there are pitfalls in each. So those are the four yogas, you guys. The four classical yogas. And there are pitfalls in each of them. So I want to talk briefly about the pitfalls in each of them, okay? The first pitfall, the pitfall in service beyond self or bodhisattva activity. Well, we need to be careful of an altruistic cover story, right? For our activities. A jiva cover story, right? An altruistic cover to fulfill little Tim's needs, to alleviate big Tim's guilt, to seek praise or respect, to prove my power to save all you people so you can get enlightened like I am, right? You got to be careful with that stuff, right? That's a pitfall, an altruistic cover story. Do you understand what I mean? It centers on unequal relationships. It centers on karma yoga is not about unequal relationships. It centers on the fact that I'm pulling you guys up from the depths of whatever sewer you're in, right? I'm fixing you by telling you how to calm down your monkey mind. Unequal. But karma yoga is equal. You do it. You serve. It's not unequal. It also can involve a negative judgment, because my ego is superior to those who receive my help. I'm the enlightened teacher, right? I'm the enlightened teacher. You guys are kind of out of it. Look at you, just look at your mind just whirling around. I can just see it, right? Whoa, who's this eye who can see it? Who, right? Be careful. Be careful. Those people are dirty. I'm not. They're addicts. I never had any addiction. I have self-control. I sit in Zazen every day. I've done it for 40 years. Look at you guys. Right? But that's not karma yoga. And it's fake karma yoga. It's fake karma yoga. And a lot of religion is made up of mostly fake karma yoga. We need to be very careful, don't you think? Yeah.
So is there
Well, good. She wants to know if good karma and bad karma relates to karma yoga. Well, karma yoga is all based on creating good karma by joining yourself with your activity, whether it's manual activity or serving others. So that's all good karma. But if it's got this altruistic cover story, it's actually not good karma. It just thinks it's good karma. Does that make sense? And if people who are being helped sense that they're being judged, if you sense I'm judging you because your zazen's not very good, you know, or whatever, then it increases your pain. Then that's not karma yoga. I'm not yoking to you. I'm increasing your pain. I'm increasing your pain. So we have to be careful about this. We have to be careful about this. And the karma yogi radically accepts each person as he is. Myself, as I am. I radically accept my inadequacies as I am, and your inadequacies. So instead of wanting to... we all want to fix. We all want to fix. I'd like to fix all you guys so that you know the clear sky mind, right? But who is this I who wants to fix? It's not empathic, not karma yoga. I want to fix because it gives me a sense of control. I want a sense of control. I'm the Zen teacher. I'm the psychologist. I'm the one who can do this. I've been trained for 32 years, 48 years, 64 years, whatever, right? But actually, we have no control. Jiva has no control. Monkey mind has no control. Forget it. But through karma yoga, or through bhakti yoga, or through raja yoga, great control. But it's not my control. It's the universe just controlling itself, just moving through us. As it is. As it is. And all I can do is offer my kindness, the kindness of my from my heart, knowing that I'm not going to really solve anything. The other thing that we do in karma yoga that we've got to be careful of is become workaholics. We become Zen practice-aholics. And maybe you guys don't do this, but in the old days with Katagiri, a lot of us became Zen practice-aholics. And we neglected our families, our spouses. Be careful. We need to be careful. That's not really karma yoga. So that's a shadow side of karma yoga. That's why we need to do the other yogas sometimes. That's when maybe we need to come back to raja yoga. Just sitting. The limitations of raja yoga, of zazen. Well, I think the main limitation I touched on already is that sometimes zazen you just sit and think all the time. You just sit and plan all the time. You just sit and worry all the time. And it seems pointless. Pointless. Why sit facing a wall just worrying and thinking? I mean, you could be worrying and thinking. So that's why sitting practices, we need to have these complementary practices. We need to have devotional practices. We need to have work practice and play practice. Because sitting in and of itself is cool, but it's not always cool. And it needs to be complemented with these others. What about bhakti yoga? What's the shadow side of bhakti yoga? Well, what's one? Guru worship. Guru worship. Well, be careful of guru worship, right? Be careful of roshi worship. Be careful, right? Be careful. You know what happens. Talk about inequality. Talk about inequality. Talk about surrendering your own good sense. And also, bhakti practice has another limitation, one true way. This is the one true way. She's the guru. He's the guru. He's the teacher. We all dress like him. We act like him. We talk like him. We're carbon copies of him because he's the true guru. His is the true way. Bhakti practice has that limitation. Right? All these limitations are based on our own insecurity, and that's just part of living. We're insecure. Jnana yoga. Everybody remember what jnana yoga is? That's the one where you say, not this, and then who, if not this. Well, the limitations of that one is it's very difficult because it involves no practice. If you tell a jnana yogi you're practicing, they'll say, what? Well, I do zazen every day. Who is this you who's doing zazen? What's zazen? What are you doing that for? Who is this? What is this? So you have no practice. Oh, I bow and chant. You bow? What's bowing? What is it? B-O-W or W-O-B? What is it? Look into it. Look into it. So it's very... So you can do it anywhere you want, right? It's existential. Deep existential questioning. But since you've got no practice to go with it, it can be very dispiriting. It can turn into some sort of Kierkegaardian questioning. Do you know? Is that too big of a word for me to use for you guys? I just did all this studying when I was younger, so this stuff comes up anyway. I won't get into that unless you want me to. So there we have it, the four yogas, and you can see how they're all part and parcel of Zen practice. And you can do one of them, or two of them, or four of them. It's better to do more than one, or you'll get caught by the shadow side. You'll get caught by the shadow side. And you'll get caught anyway, We just make peace with our shadow, right? Our shadow is... this jiva, this monkey mind, is just the mind of the universe. Just the mind of the universe tripping out on itself, right? So... that's our practice. Why not finish with a quote from the Bard of Hibbing? Why not? Through these practices, we lose ourselves. We lose ourselves through devotional, through work, through zazen, through deep asking. We lose ourselves. We reappear. We suddenly see we have nothing to fear. Nothing to fear. These are paths of awakening, you guys. They're awakening. You can wake up at any moment. Not later on, but at any moment you can wake up. And you will. It's not just for some people. Some more people who are more disposed to spirituality or Zen practice. Give me a break. That's just your all your stuff, or your mama's stuff, or something, or your daddy's stuff, or something. Well, that's what I want to say, and I think we got about time for one more question. One more question. Well, we had a couple already. Yeah.
You said something a little earlier that is equally exciting and troubling to me about the difference between work and play, and I think what you were saying was that if you're approaching it from a karma yoga place,
yes,
that there is no difference.
That's right. That's what I was saying. Did you hear what he said, you guys? Did you have a question after that?
Can I talk a little bit more about that?
Oh, can I talk a little bit more about that? Yes, I can talk a little bit more about that. So last week I had to testify three times at the legislature. That was my work last week, to testify three times about mental health, about services to kids, mental health services for kids. And that was work. That was work. I had to prepare. I had to do it in front of a whole bunch of people. I had to get dressed up. I had to be respectful. I had to pay attention to the time. But by the third time I did it, it was wonderful play because I was so into it. I was so into it. My heart was open. I felt joined to them, to those legislators, even the Tea Party ones, as I talked about. I did. I can't help it. I did. It was play. It was telling them about how it helps kids in schools who are starting to have some symptoms of a bipolar or depression, how it helps them to have someone there for them. It was play to tell them that. It was work, I guess, but it didn't feel like work. It felt like play. But at work, play, whatever, whatever. There's no difference when you do it wholeheartedly. There's just no difference. And, of course, I was watching guys play chess at Dunn Brothers yesterday. And I was thinking, well, is that work or play? Because they're really trying to win. So maybe it's more like work. But they were very relaxed and very one-pointed and very in the now. So maybe it was karma yoga. Maybe it was karma yoga, which does not differentiate. It just doesn't differentiate. How's that?
It's helpful. It's certainly something to strive for.
Pardon?
It's something to strive for.
Yeah, but don't strive too much for it. Don't. I don't recommend striving for these things. I don't recommend doing any of these yogas as strivings. I know you want to strive for it, but I really don't recommend it. If they become shoulds, well, we lose our life. We lose the life of Zen, which is already here. The big mind, Brahman, is already here. So, yes, focus. But maybe not too much striving. Does that make sense?
I'm afraid to say anything.
Oh. See. And who is it who's afraid? And what is fear? What's your name? What's your name?
Joe.
And who is Joe? Who is Joe? Who is he? I don't think we have any time for more questions, so thank you, and I'll turn it over to Karen.